Welcome to Mortgage Space. My name is Alan Medeiros, and today I'm so excited to actually have a guest speaker. His name is Anselmo Moreno, and I've had the privilege of working with this gentleman for over 10 years. You know, I use this term 10 years, but have you read any of the Malcolm Gladwell series of books?
I have not.
He talked about mastery, and what does mastery come from? He talks about the great Wayne Gretzky, and he talks about even Mozart. These people are incredibly gifted people, but they say mastery comes from having, at minimum, 5 years or 10,000 hours of experience. So you are a credit master, because I know that over the last 10 years, you've created over 20,000 hours worth of time and energy in your craft. So proud to say, I know a credit professional expert master.
You know, I there's like in this world, right, information is at your fingertips, and you can find information on almost any subject in an instant. You're a quick Google search away from thinking you're an expert, but it's not after, you know, handling cases of various scopes and sizes, and just the weirdest things come across your desk when you practice credit every day. And because of that, now 12 years into my practice, there's not a case that I can see that I probably have not solved before.
Sure.
You know, and because of that, I'm very confident when I talk about helping consumers improve their credit scores or navigate credit issues, because I have likely seen the problem before, and therefore I have solved it before. You know, and so whenever I meet a new client, I always assure them I've seen this before, or I've dealt with this company before. I know the best way to navigate it. So it is. It's just, you know, it just kind of comes with being around this business for so long.
It's always amazing to me when I call you and I ask you specifically about a trade line or a name of a collection company, you can actually tell me, well, it's this particular hospital, right?
Yes.
And that's amazing.
Yes.
But, you know, that comes through the number of at-bats. I like to say, you know, the difference between somebody that hits the ball 2 out of 10 times versus 3 out of 10 times in the major leagues, $1 million a year. You have to have a lot of at-bats. You know, and I've been very fortunate in my career to see thousands of applications, right? And thousands of credit reports. I can tell you we can't help everybody, but those number of at-bats created the opportunity to be somewhat discerning on things that will go immediately. You know, this is going to be a great file, and those things that will work with a little bit of help. And then those that really, they're not ready, and they're truly just not ready, because there are components that we have in the mortgage finance industry that are just, they're necessaries. One is credit. Two is capacity, their ability to repay that debt. And three is going to be the collateral. It's that house that's holding up the loan, right? So those are the three C's out of the four. The four is character. And character really is like, what is this person's attitude towards debt? What is their attitude about managing their funds? When I look at your bank statements, I'm not just looking at what you spend. I'm looking at, are you being conservative with your money? Do you have some margin for error? I mean, you've left a little bit of money on the table so that you have some room for little Billy breaking his arm.
Yeah. I've learned to categorize people into three different components: those that spend less than they earn, those that spend all that they earn, and those that spend more than they earn, right? Those are really the three components of consumers that we will see. And guess who has the highest credit score?
One.
The ones those that spend less than they earn. You know, those really will generally have the highest credit score. And those that spend more than they earn is because they're using supplemental income, and that's credit cards.
Yes.
They supplement their income with their credit cards, and that is the biggest score demoter, if you will, is just carrying balances on credit cards. And you'll see that. People want to say, how do I improve my credit score quickly? Without looking at their credit report, what comes out of my mouth naturally is just, do you have credit card balances? And if so, pay them off. Not pay them down. You know, don't bring them down to 50%, 30%. Pay them off. Zero is the magic number.
So how many of these people that you talk to have that kind of margin to be able to just pay them off?
Well, that's an interesting point. Probably none of them, but it's because they are not managing their credit cards right. And so it's okay to have credit cards. In fact, you need to have a credit card or two to have a good credit score. But if you use the credit card, you need to be in a position to pay it off in a moment's notice.
Sure.
You always want to have a good credit score, right? If you're carrying long-term debt on a credit card, then you're not in a position to pay it off quickly, then you're not in a position to pull the trigger on a mortgage loan quickly, right? So if you're doing that, then you're not mortgage ready.
Nope. Let me ask this question. So what are the different categories of debt? Meaning, For me, I like to say there are basic categories. One would be revolving debts. What is a revolving debt?
It's just any credit card.
Okay.
Any line of credit that will revolve. It's really the payment revolves. So the payment is going to change based on your utilization. If you have a $100 balance on a credit card, your minimum payment's $30. If you charge it up to $5,000, the minimum payment's going to be like $300. So the payment revolves. It's not a fixed payment. And that can happen on any type of credit card, open-ended credit card, or line of credit. We don't see lines of credits too much. You know, that would be like a home equity line of credit. Sure. Or those aren't too common nowadays. They do exist, but it's just mainly credit cards. And then you have installment loans, which those are going to be your typical car loan, home loan, student loan, where the payment is technically the same throughout the life of the loan. Personal loans, where you just have one fixed payment throughout the life of the loan. And those are going to be the two main components on a credit score or a credit report. Those two types of debts.
So I have a question specifically about installment loans. So if you get closer to the end of that installment, let's say, for instance, you have a 60-month car payment and you only have 3 car payments left. How does that affect your score when you pay the car off?
That's a good question. It doesn't affect it very much.
Really?
You already have the benefit of that trade line because of the 5 years worth of active payments that you did.
Sure.
Right? So you're already receiving the benefit from it. Paying it off, there's no bonus points because you paid it off. Yeah. A lot of people think that way, and so we'll have to guide them and say, no, for example, if you could use the money to pay off your car or use the money to pay off your credit cards, I will guide you to pay off your credit
Absolutely.
Cards more times than not, simply because there's more points there. So yeah, a lot of people misunderstand the way that installment debt is calculated and how it affects your score. They help your score tremendously, but it's not the payoff that helps your score. It's the 60 months of on-time payments or the 36 months of on-time payments
that is helps huge. Your score. Absolutely. I'm glad you brought that up. So you and I have kind of slightly different viewpoints, because when I look at debt, I look at it as collective. I mean, what is the monthly obligation that you have that shows on credit that we're going to have to use in your debt to income calculation, right? So if I see an auto debt, historically, that is the biggest debt that you're going to carry outside of a mortgage, right? Mm-hmm. And that, to me, is a hindrance in your buying power. However, if I know that that thing's been paid on time, you have less than 12 months, some banks will give you a buy and not have to calculate that in your debt ratios.
Oh, because it's going to be paid off in
Correct.
The next 12
months? In the next 12 months. So they know that money's been freed up. Now, the one exception to that is a lease. Auto leases, they say historically, they will buy another vehicle or lease another vehicle. So they won't give you a buy on a lease, but on a purchase, on a vehicle specifically, when you're within 12 months, ideally 10 or less, they don't typically put it in your debt ratios. This is huge, because some lenders don't know this, and they just kind of think, well, I can't do this because this debt is showing. But once you run automated underwriting, it will actually manually or automatically exclude that debt. So there's coding on the back of a credit report. I don't know if you know this, Anselmo, but there's interfaces. When a credit report is pulled, it's actually raw data. And we get a report that's very pretty. I mean, it shows some beautiful like lines. It shows you the name of the creditor, when it was open, when's the last activity date, trended credit, meaning the last balances, what your payment cycles have been, what you've been paying versus the minimum payments. So these are all things we look at. But the computer interface, it just knows what type of account, the age of the account, the delinquencies on the account, if there are any, relative balances to limits, and it looks at patterns. So these are all in the algorithms of the actual underwriting systems. But what you said was really powerful to me. You said if they have money set aside and they have a choice of paying off a vehicle versus paying off credit card debt, you're advising to use that money to pay off the debt. And the reason why I think, and this is just me, like I said, I see it from the other side of the table, is they are leaving points on the table, right?
Right.
Is that
carrying credit card balances, yeah. They're leaving points on the table.
Absolutely. And yeah. I think that's huge. You know, there are other two different types of debt, if you will, for credit that I see. An installment debt for a home loan is graded differently than installment debt for shorter term. So it could be, you know, an auto payment, or if you had equal installment payments on a particular purchase that you made. Student loans, longer, but those there are categorized differently on the mortgage report when we see it and how it actually is interfacing with the system. So that's another thing. And then also net 30 types of accounts. Previously, American Express, the only way you could get one is if you pay the balance in full. But there were no limits.
Yeah,
it was just an odd expense. Those
are referred to normally as charge cards.
Charge cards, perfect. Yeah, so those actually do have an effect on our scores as well, right? So, if you have an American Express or a card like that that shows the balance is the payment, we have to actually request the consumer to bring us an actual statement because it's not realistic. Maybe you used $1,100 that particular month, but you're going to pay that full $1,100 off. I don't want to use $1,100 in your debt ratio calculation, right?
Yeah, that can throw the numbers off pretty big.
Pretty big.
That's interesting. So on the going back to the auto loan one, that left me a bit intrigued. Do you think that there's a score requirement as well? So like it'll exclude the car payment from the debt ratios
No.
if the score is over a certain amount?
No, it's specific to the type of loan. So if the debt itself is less than 10 months left in an installment loan, the automated underwriting will exclude that debt. You can manually exclude it, but I usually like the automated systems to do it on its own. That way I know I have valid findings. See, the funny thing is that most lenders out there, if they do their job correctly, will run your application directly through an underwriting engine. Okay, so this underwriting engine has its own calculation specific to the loan type. So a VA underwriting engine will be different from a conventional underwriting engine versus a government underwriting system engine for USDA and also for FHA. So FHA has its own underwriting engine. Each one has embedded in that their own criteria. So for example, let's look at medical collections. You just brought that up in another video we actually did, but medical collections collectively, if they are under $2,000, then FHA loans don't require them to be paid. But did you know conventional, any collection account, no matter the balance, if it's in collections or charged off, will not require to be paid?
I didn't know that.
Yes, that's a newer change. However, you still need to get guidance from automated underwriting.
Regardless of the balance?
Correct. Now, here's the difference. And I'll provide some documentation for you because I need you and your staff to know this too because you guys are doing credit challenges all the time. Your score will still be tilted. You won't have an opportunity to improve your score if it's reporting an open active collection, right? Now, if there's a past due balance, we may be required to pay that. If it has a collection account that shows past due balance rather than a charge off, we may be required to pay that. So FHA though, requires that any balances above the 2000, that you take the collective past due balances, okay, add them together, and multiply that by 5%, and that's the qualifying debt we need to use, even though they may not have the ability to come after you for judgment or any past collection activity they should have done prior to the execution of that time frame. So these are kind of big deals.
So the big myth that we see really revolves around the push from, in my opinion, mortgage lenders that say just that, you don't have to pay your medical related debt in order to buy a house, or just that statement by itself of if there's a collection that's been charged off and it's unpaid and you go conventional, you don't have to deal with that debt, right? But
I would say you don't have to deal with it. I'm just saying you may be able to still obtain a loan, but...
And I'm not saying use particularly, but it's just the statement in itself will lead the consumer to believe I can get a mortgage loan without dealing with this repo, or I can get a mortgage loan without dealing with this past due medical bill. But the reality is that the credit score does not ignore it. So you can have
exactly, you can have
the FHA engine Huge. Or the conventional underwriting engine ignore it, but it's still not ignored by the FICO scoring engine.
No.
And so a lot of the times, you know, we're talking about getting mortgage ready, you're leaving points on the table by not taking care of this $50 medical bill, where you're leaving a lot of points on the table by not taking care of this $500 medical bill or credit card debt or cell phone debt, right? All of these negative items that can be on the credit report are costing you points.
Yes.
And points end up costing you mortgage terms. So you can get a higher interest rate. You may not approve for certain loans. There's a lot of variables here, but ultimately, when we're dealing about getting you mortgage ready, we have to understand, are you leaving any points on the table? And do the economics of taking care of this pencil out?
Meaning, yes,
if you can spend $500 to get 50 points because you took care of this medical collection, are you going to get a greater benefit than those $500 spent?
Yes.
Right? So we always take a look at that, is where do we get the points for the consumer and how fast can we get them, and is the consumer willing and able to? And do they understand that, yes, the loan officer said, don't worry about medical bills, and I'm telling them take care of these medical bills simply because you're going to get more points.
But in some of that's the difference, I think, between people that communicate,
yes,
and people that just kind of fly by the seat of their pants. In any conversation, people will hear you, but not necessarily internalize or understand what you said.
Yeah, very true.
There's credit speak, there's mortgage speak, and then there's other people that actually understand what we say and others that don't, right? So we have to be able to break these things down to say, the takeaways from this meeting are, this is what I recommend you do. So what you've done just beautifully and masterfully, as we talked about at the very beginning of this podcast, is you always communicate with me. You know, you say, hey, Alan, this is where we're at right now. This will take between 30 to 90 days, 6 months. There's some challenges we have here, but if they're committed, I'm able to make these things happen. And here's the time frame. And many times it's right on spot, sometimes early, which is even awesome, but sometimes it takes a little bit longer. Unfortunately, you've used this before, I've used this before. When they come to our table, that credit report wasn't an overnight thing.
Right.
I mean, those things happened over a collection of time, whether it be last month, year, 7 years, a lifetime. I mean, some people really have different experiences based off of life happening around them, right?
Life so happens.
It's huge. It's huge. Some things I wanted to ask you real quick is, I have seen this, but I'm not seeing really good literature on it, so I just wanted your take on it. So if somebody has a revolving account, and they have one to, say, three cards that are open, and they use the card but pay the balance in full every month, will they still maintain a quality credit score?
That's a loaded question. and I think that this is a big issue nowadays with the management of credit cards, right? So, and again, living in the information age, you can Google what should I leave my credit card balances at, and you will find whatever answer you're looking for.
Sure.
So if you're a consumer and you want to carry balances because you just like to spend a little bit, right, you will find an answer on the internet that caters to what you want to hear, right? But ultimately, what it boils down to is that the way that you manage the credit cards is going to directly reflect on your credit score.
Sure.
And I always give this example. I always ask my client, do you know anybody that has just really good credit, like unknowingly good credit? And most of the time they're like, yes, my grandma, or yes, my mom, or
yeah,
my dad. Or,
yeah.
Like, what's their credit score? And they're like, retarded. It's like 810 or 840, right? It's like, do they carry credit card balances? And they immediately go, no, they don't. Like, and I'm like, yes.
This is a revelation for them, yeah, right? Their eyes open like, oh!
They hate debt.
Yeah.
And they hate to pay interest. So what do
That's
they do?
The key. That was my point.
So what do? They just pay things off and try to use very little.
Yes.
And I was like, and it's an interesting concept because those are always going to be the high elite credit scores.
Sure.
810, 820, 840, is they just don't carry any credit card debt. They're not trying to time it. They're not trying to keep it at 30% or 20%. They just don't carry it. If they use it, they pay it right off right away. And those are going to be the ones that are consistently going to clock in at a very high score. So back to answer your question, if you're going to use your credit cards, which you should have credit cards if you want to have a high credit score, you want to be in a position to pay them off in a moment's notice. Because if you're going to use your credit and you understand the game, you know that you have to apply for credit when those balances are zero.
Yes.
So for some people, you know what they do is they use their credit card and pay it off every month, which is fine. You use your gas card and at the end of the month, you pay it off. Like, that's probably the normal way that people manage it. But the problem is that the credit cards report once a month.
Yes.
And they're going to report your statement balance.
Yes.
So if you let it close out and then you get your statement and then the statement says that you're maxed out and then you pay it off, they're going to report to the bureaus that you're maxed out. And you're never going to be timing it correctly so that they're reporting the fact that you paid it off. They're just always going to be reporting the fact that you're maxed out. And if the timing is wrong, you will always be maxed out and you will always be leaving points on the table. So my best advice to my clients is, pay it off before the statement closes, and when the statement closes, it closes at zero. They update that to the bureaus that you're at zero, and you get all the points that you deserve, right? So if you're going to be paying it off every month, just pay it off before the statement closes as opposed to after the statement closes. That's probably the best piece of advice that I can give. Or if you're carrying a balance because you just how to finance a big purchase and you're going to pay it off, just know that your credit is not optimized at that point and you don't use it for until you pay off the balance. You know, I give the analogy all the time. You know, if you're going to go buy tires for your car, it could run you a few hundred bucks, maybe even a few thousand bucks. And if you put it on a credit card, just know that you can't use your credit score or that you're leaving a lot of points on the table until you pay off that balance. You know, so if you're going to put yourself in a position to buy a house or obtain a mortgage or refinance your mortgage, you want to make sure that you have very little or no credit card debt in order to have all the points that are available to you.
Absolutely. You brought up this point of the card for tires.
Right.
So one of the techniques that I think that some people try to utilize is actually go out and get jewelry, right? Because it's easy. It's an in-store credit basis. But what they typically do is, from my understanding, they report the full purchase value as the limit. So technically, in my mind, doesn't that show 100% utilization?
Yeah, so it's actually, so the way that the credit reporting system is designed, the FICO scoring algorithm, especially the older models that are used in mortgage space, in mortgage lending right now, if there's a absent credit limit, then they will take what's known as the high credit as a limit.
Yes, and that's so, one of the categories that we see on the credit
report. Right, so on the little credit report, once it compiles all the information, there's a category for the actual credit limit, and then there's another category for what's known as the high credit, which is basically the highest amount you've ever owed on this particular credit line. And so if there's no credit limit, which sometimes credit limits are blank, then the system will automatically take the high credit as the credit limit. So if you finance, say, a necklace at a jewelry store and the high credit is 1100 because that's how much the purchase was, and you owe 1100 because you just got it, then you're maxed out.
Yes, and that's what I was bringing up, is because in those situations, it didn't necessarily benefit the borrower. Now, it does have its merits, meaning as they get going forward and they're reestablishing, it does do its job, albeit at a high interest rate.
Yeah.
I mean, you're going to pay probably twice or three times for that same jewelry if you're not smart about it, right? So I advise clients, hey, use this very sparingly. The other option is a secured credit card.
Much cheaper.
What do you think about them? What is a secured card? I mean, some of the listeners don't know what a secured credit card is.
It's probably the best, mechanism or tool that you can use right now to rebuild or build your credit for the first time, for the second time, third time. You can use the secured card. And the reason why they're so popular is they're pretty much a guaranteed approval. Mm-hmm. There's nothing worse than sending a client to go get a credit card at a department store and then having them get declined at the register, right? It's not a good feeling.
That's emotional.
For them to say.
And there's nothing worse. Yeah, we'll just applied.
We'll send you the decision in the mail. Like,
yeah.
You know what that means.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so the secured credit card is a very easy tool. It's basically a collateral credit card. You give them the collateral and they give you the credit line. And the collateral is typically in the form of a cash deposit at the bank.
Sure.
You put down $300, they put it on hold, and then they give you a credit card with a $300 limit. And if you use it well over 6 to 8 months, they generally refund your deposit.
Absolutely.
And you get to keep the card.
Don't you notice that once they've done it for 3 or 4 months, they wind up getting offers in the mail?
Right. Because now they've established a pattern of responsible use on the credit card, and then everybody wants to give you one.
When I talk to clients about doing this, especially if they have very thin credit, we call it thin credit in mortgage finance. It's just you have one open active trade. It's not very strong. The scores themselves don't reflect much stability. I say you might want to go open a trade line through a secured card. So go to your credit union, go to your bank, give them $200, $300 and say, hold this as security, right? And use this card. And I just tell them, put a tank of gas on it and pay it off.
Yep.
Put a tank of gas in it. You're going to use it anyways. Pay it off. You don't need to pay interest. Right, but the idea is you have usage of that card.
You just said a key thing. You actually, it doesn't cost you anything if you don't carry a balance.
Correct.
As opposed to going to the jewelry store and
absolutely
spending money on
jewelry. Huge, you know, benefit there.
You spend hundreds of dollars that you probably weren't planning on spending.
No.
With the credit card, it doesn't really cost you anything. And credit unions particularly have a different product as well, known as a secured loan, which is just like a credit card, except it's a loan. So on the credit report, it shows up installment instead of revolving.
Mm.
And all it is another collateral type product where you give them, say, $500, put them in a savings account.
That's interesting. I didn't even know they had that.
They put it on hold. So you have $500 in your savings,
sure,
but it's not available.
Okay.
And then they loan you $500. Right? So I love it even more because you're not even out any money.
Yeah.
You get the money right back. You get this loan for 480. And every time you make a payment, they release that same amount on hold.
That is a really good product.
So you're just like trading money. And it's not an open-ended item.
Understood.
Like a credit card is
sure.
You basically keep it forever. But a loan is 6 to 7 months.
Sure.
You pay off the loan, and now you have one paid off trade line. Yes. And I advise my clients that are coming out of a bankruptcy or maybe reestablishing for the first time, you know, some type of credit catastrophe. We're rebuilding credit, get this loan, pay it off, get it again, pay it off. And you're just using the same money over and over and creating paid off trade lines from the credit report. And it's an awesome thing because it's like, honestly, maybe 3% interest rate that they're charging you.
That's,
so it's nothing
because
it's
on a 6 month really loan. Good.
You literally pay like $5 in interest. So it's a great credit rebuilding product. I always advise consumers to get a secured loan and a secured card. And once you do these two items for a 6 month period, you can go to any department store you want and they're going to give you credit. And then now you can, you know, establish credit and the credit score is just going to be very, very, very solid. After 12 months, 18 months, 24 months, you got to have these steps. I often advise people, like, even if you have negative items, if you focus your money on rebuilding credit, and by the time you have 24 months under your belt with new items, maybe the negative items have aged out, the only thing that's going to be left is the good stuff, and sure. Your credit score can be really, really high.
Yeah. You know, you brought up a point. It's called age out. Now, there's lots of myths out there, and there's information you can find on the internet. What does age out mean?
There's a statute of limitations that governs how long negative items can be reported on a consumer's credit report. A lot of people may know that as a 7-year rule. So unpaid debts or regular negative incidents can credit report for 7 years from the date. Well, they all have different dates. So I'll give you an example. A late payment on a credit report will report for 7 years from the date of the late payment. So if you pay late right now, it'll be there for 7 more years. As opposed to, say, an unpaid credit card that you had a balance on and you just had to stop paying on it, that will report for 7 years from the last time you made a late payment. So basically from the first late payment, as opposed to when it was charged off, because they'll get charged off 6 months later, but that's not when the 7-year clock starts. The 7-year clock starts the last time you made, the first time you missed a payment. So that's a little technical thing there, and it can be very important because if it can mean the difference between waiting 7 years or 7.5 years. So
which is significant.
It's significant when you're ready, right?
Yeah.
So, especially if you're ready right now and I'm telling you got to wait 1 more year because you can either pay this account or wait 1 more year. You're like, crap, you know, this 1 more year can seem like an opportunity. So it's important to understand those details. Medical debts, those will report for 7 years from the date of service.
Yeah.
But then it gets a little more complicated if you get sued. So judgments have a different statute of limitations. Those are 10 years that they can be affecting you. And it can renew they can credit report, or it can renew the time that it's being credit reported. It's about one of the very few things that can be renewed. A lot of people think that if you talk to a credit collection agency that it renews your 7 years, or if they sell it to another agency that it renews the 7 years, or if you make a payment that it can renew the 7 years. And nothing can renew the 7 years. But the way that judgments work is that they will affect someone trying to get a mortgage for 10 years from the date that they obtained the judgment, not from the last time you made a payment. And they have up to 4 years to get a judgment.
And if they fail to do so in the 4 years,
they can't get it anymore.
Do you see that they continue to take action after the 4 years and try to collect the money?
Okay, it gets really complicated.
Okay.
So I just said that you can't, if you make a payment, you can't renew the 7 years, right? So if you are waiting on an account to hit 7 years, and then you make a payment, it'll still fall off when it's supposed to fall off on the 7th year, right? It doesn't restart the 7 years.
Sure.
But the 4-year statute of limitations can be renewed by a payment.
Oh.
So if you have a 6.5-year-old debt and they just happen to get you to make a payment, right? Then you just renewed the 4 years, not the 7, the 4. The statute of limitations still for a judgment, and then they can file a lawsuit against you. And it gets even crazier because my background is in debt collections. That's where I come from.
That's right. You used to be a debt collector.
So what would happen in that world is debt collectors working their own desk,
they would mail in a money order for $10 on behalf of a debtor to push a file through legal, because otherwise the legal department would say, no, this is aged out. So they're like, oh, well, this client magically made a $10 payment, and then they would
push. Is that considered legal fraud?
It's absolutely.
Oh my gosh, I can't believe a collection agency would have the audacity to commit fraud.
It's absolutely against the law, but it's just to understand how things can happen, and if you don't know to look for that, you don't know like how did this even happen. And so that kind of experience is what makes us so valuable,
sure,
in helping people navigate credit issues.
That's scary. I didn't even know they did that kind of sneaky stuff.
You're not supposed to
know. Ah,
they're not supposed to do it.
Jeez, Anselmo, you're giving the keys to the world away right now. You know, a couple more questions. This podcast is kind of going long, but I'm learning so much just having this conversation. It's always neat to talk to somebody that's actually active in an industry that is constantly moving and changing. You know, much like the mortgage industry, I think that your industry is dynamic. Yeah. Dynamic in the sense that it's not going to be the same, you know, a year from now, 6 months from now. And there's constantly this struggle between, I would say, legal changes to procedural changes to acceptance and then implementation, right? So in our industry, we have something called the CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Board. That also governs credit lines of credit cards, student loans, debt collectors, all these different industries. And the whole premise was not just to ferret out the bad players, but also to keep accountable good players and keeping them in tune with what's going on, right? So not to get political at all, but under the Trump administration, they've dismantled some pieces of the CFPB because the access to credit was such a limiting factor and the fines that were imposed were just unreal. You know, this agency had no governing power, but they were able to enforce things and not with elected officials. It's just like they walked into shop and said, show me these records. And the odd thing was, and this is just scuttlebutt and not something I can validate, but they would have these auditors come in that were actually just newbies at a college that basically were told, this is what you're looking for. And they had no way of really having some credibility in that arena, which is scary to me, right? It's almost like you just graduated with a law degree and I want you to try this case. I'm like, well, I have no field experience. Well, I read a book and I saw this case law. But are you really going to be the best candidate out there talking and enforcing, you know, regulation that's new? So it's crazy to me to even hear that.
But the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau it's actually very, very relevant in our industry.
Absolutely.
Well, because they did. They set up shop and went after the three bureaus and really took them to town. There were some interesting findings that were done when the bureau first came about. Obviously, with the recent administration, Trump actually appointed a new director,
mm-hmm.
you know, that had a completely 180 degree view of how the organization should be ran, as opposed to the previous director that was appointed by Obama. So there's been some changes, but overall the Bureau continues to do its work. And it's kind of interesting because prior to them, it was a Federal Trade Commission who was like the consumer watchdog of the industry. And they overlapped on a lot of cases.
Yeah.
But ultimately, you know, they're supposed to be the voices of the consumer, and they are kind of disrupting a little bit the industry, but I think it's for the consumer's benefit.
Yes.
The weird part is that nobody knows about them. Yeah. Only like
professionals industries, know about industry them, right? Professionals.
And
yeah.
It's mainly because it's like for people in the mortgage space, you're like, oh, they created all these new rules, and now yeah. there's all this new red tape for us to be able to do business. But they're really supposed to be to help the consumer
yes.
navigate the industry better. But
I think the spirit of legislation was correct. It's consumer advocacy, protection, and provision so that there are less people taken advantage of, right? But the hardship is that sometimes you don't know what you don't know.
Yep, and you don't know that they're there.
And this is the experience across the board, right? Going to purchase a vehicle, there are some things that car salesmen know that you have no clue about. Right, so leasing a vehicle versus purchasing a vehicle. If you know somebody in the industry, take them with you.
Yeah.
They're going to be the better advocate for helping you to get the best terms, right? So when you don't have that trusted professional, I'm sure that you see this all the time. It's probably frustrating to no end to you, is to see a credit professional or a credit fixer or a person that advertises online or does something that just seems unscrupulous, doesn't provide any type of true backing, doesn't have the track record, doesn't have that 10,000, 20,000 hours of experience, just going and creating shop. I mean, how does that make you feel?
It used to bother me, but now, you know, I realize that the there's not really competition because
sure.
they're just not
yeah.
at the same level. What does bother me, though, is that they take advantage of consumers.
Yes.
And that does bother me because we get the consumers then later and we realize, like, no, what they told you was completely
yeah.
incorrect. And
that's
now
scary.
You've wasted
thousands
of
dollars.
Life.
Yeah, a lot of these
thousands
people
are
paying these fees, but then they're not really getting what they think they're getting.
And so that definitely does bother me, especially because the target consumer is the ill-informed consumer, the consumer that doesn't, you know how to protect themselves, that just is very trusting. And so that's their target consumer because that's the one that's going to believe what they're saying and not necessarily question them. Like, oh, this sounds too good to be true. Let me look into it a little bit more. Because all you have to do is Google credit repair and you learn a lot about how the industry works. More importantly, the no advance fee metric. So credit repair companies are not allowed to charge an advance fee, which is very interesting because you have to adjust the way that you do business in order to comply with the Credit Repair Act. And so a lot of these companies that charge upfront fees of $1,000, $2,500 are immediately violating the Credit Repair Act. And that's a big sign that you should turn the other way. The other thing, very interesting one, is that you can't make any guarantees as to the outcome of deleting specific things.
Yeah.
So when they say, I'm going to delete your repo, I'm going to delete all your collections, that's already, again, a very misleading statement and in direct violation of the act. So these are the types of things that are make for an unfair advantage, I believe. So if you're shopping and someone's telling you that they're going to delete these things and I'm telling you, no, we're going to have to pay them, you're probably going to... A lot of people will not choose us because they like
yeah,
what they're hearing over
absolutely.
There.
Absolutely. And I've seen that happen before in mortgage finance. You tell them this is really the best scenario for you. This is appropriate for your financial situation. And they just keep knocking on doors until they find someone that tells them yes.
Right.
And the reality is there's a reason why we do this. We have a fiduciary responsibility to protect you, but also protect the bank, right? So I'm going to give advice that's prudent, relevant, and hopefully put you in the best financial situation for you and your family, right? I don't like disruption of life through losing a house. That's a just devastating thing for people, right? So two more quick topics, hopefully.
Yeah.
What is your view of bankruptcy? And what are the differences between a Chapter 7 and Chapter 13?
I personally think that bankruptcy is a very useful tool for the consumer that needs it. A big question that we get all the time is, should I file for bankruptcy or should I go through you guys and improve, fix my credit, essentially? And the answer, like most credit questions, is it depends.
Sure.
But I think bankruptcy can be a very useful tool in the right spot. One of the big things that I dislike about bankruptcy is that, mainly I guess in my dislike is with the bankruptcy attorneys themselves, is that they will advise a consumer to file bankruptcy even when their debts are 5 or 6 years old. And, you know, as a consumer advocate and consultant, I don't see the point of filing bankruptcy when all of your debt is going to hit the 7-year mark next year.
Sure.
Right? It does not make sense. So definitely there's a time and the right consumer for the bankruptcy. It's one of my favorite cases to look at. Is to be able to figure out, is bankruptcy the best case for you or is it not? But I do believe in the bankruptcy and I do believe that it is a do-over or a get-out-of-jail card or a second chance for consumers. And I recommend it all the time where I feel like it fits correctly. But you know what's interesting? I never have to tell a client, you need to file bankruptcy. As we go through the numbers, the answer comes up all
sure.
on its own.
Yeah.
You know, and the consumer immediately knows whether it's right for them or not. So... But yes, I do like bankruptcies. And then, you know, I'm not a bankruptcy attorney, but the main consumer bankruptcies are Chapter 7 and 13. And the Chapter 7 is just your typical bankruptcy. Everything goes away. You don't have to pay anything back except for, like, student loans and child support and, you know.
Things are not dischargeable.
But they're normally done and over with in 4 months. And Chapter 13 bankruptcy is more of a repayment type of bankruptcy where the consumer has assets that they want to keep, like say you have a paid off house or a house with significant equity in it, or you make too much money to meet the bankruptcy 7 means test. So you have to go through a Chapter 13, which basically the court navigates and manages your debts, and you make a payment to the court every month, and the court distributes that.
Yeah, they call it a trustee.
Yeah. And so those are the two main ones. I really only work with Chapter 7s.
Sure.
Not that we do them, but we tend to send people over to Chapter 7s. If it's Chapter 13 is coming up, it's because the bankruptcy attorney made the decision that you would not qualify for a Chapter 7.
Cool.
Which sometimes then we would rethink the strategy.
Sure.
Because the Chapter 13 is very specific, in my opinion, for the, you know, it's a very specific case where someone would have to go through a Chapter 13.
So this is a question related to what you just discussed. So timing becomes very important. From what I'm hearing, let's just say there was a period of time that this particular consumer's credit report shows just this string of lates or string of collections, and it's centered around a major life event. Maybe becoming disabled, having an accident in the job, having someone, you know, get into a big car accident and you just mounted all these medical bills, or there was cancer or something, right? But they've recovered. It's just these things are just aging and aging and aging. You're getting so close, right? So let's just say that you're 36 months away versus being 24 months away from that being able to come off your credit, right?
Okay.
So I'll throw this twist in, and this is, again, two sides of the table. I'm looking at it from a mortgage standpoint. I know that there may be certain things that I can't get past and you don't qualify now, and I advise them to speak with you. And you go through the credit report and you give me a call and say, Alan, you know, these are going to fall off in 2 years. What is their time frame that they're trying to purchase a house? And you ask me this very directly, because I know in your mind, you're trying to calculate how many months this is going to be and whether or not it's a benefit for us to address these things now, or if this is something that we should just wait on and just let time pass. So here's an example. Let's just say that a consumer going for a veterans loan, a VA loan, or a FHA loan, they are 36 months out from this stuff falling out. Let's say 32 months or 28 months. But they can complete a Chapter 7 and they qualify. By the time that discharges, they will rebuild a credit score, okay? And they'll hit the time frames after bankruptcy in order to purchase, okay? So those situations, I think you kind of have to analyze a little bit closer, because they just might not be ready. So whether or not they can buy a house now, they're going to have to pay somebody, whether it be family that you're living with or renting, right?
Right.
But from your experience, let's just say you have a good strong mix of positive credit and then all of this collection stuff that will eventually fall off. What would you say to that scenario?
You know, you have to look at it, and it's mainly the choice comes up, or the answer comes up naturally as you do go through the analysis. So if you have a consumer that wants to buy a house, but I'm just gonna bring up a repo because it's the more common thing, and you have a repo that's $10,000, right? So you have a deficiency balance where you owe $10,000 and it's significantly hurting the score.
Sure.
And it can cause a problem for the mortgage loan. So the repo either has to be paid off, you know, right, settled, or we have to get rid of it in a bankruptcy, or we wait till the 7th year and then it goes away. And we establish that the 7th year is 24 months away from now.
Sure.
Right? So then we just look at it very simply and I say, okay, so option one is you wait 2 more years and then you buy, and the client can go, I love where I live, I don't mind waiting 2 more years. Or they can go, I'm living with my in-laws and I hate it and I want to buy yesterday, right?
Yeah.
So then you got those two scenarios. And it's all right. So if you don't want to wait, then you will probably have to settle it. If you owe 10 grand, we'll settle it for 4 or 5 thousand. So is 4 or 5 thousand worth it for you to buy now, or would you rather wait 2 years and save the 4 to 5 thousand? And everyone's answer is going to be different.
Sure.
Because everyone's concept of living standard and $4,000 to $5,000 is different. So if $5,000 is a fortune for you, you may decide to wait, especially if you have no problems where you're living now. But if you can, if you hate where you're living now, you hate the neighborhood, you hate the apartment, you know what I'm saying, and you just need to get out quickly, you might be more compelled to spend the $4,000 to $5,000 to buy now as opposed to later. And sometimes you got to do the analysis where you're spending 4 to 5 grand and you're going to buy 6 months early. And maybe that doesn't pencil out for you. Maybe you'd rather wait out the 6 months, or maybe 6 months is too much and you spend $4,000, $5,000 bucks all day to get out now. So everyone's going to be a little different. the numbers are always going to be different. I always tell client, like, where's your breaking point? Like, in this same scenario where you owe 10 grand and I can get you out of it for, say, 5,000, you're thinking about it two times. You're like, maybe. But would you do it if I can get you out for 1,000? So the client would say, yeah, absolutely. Get me out for 1,000. I'll do it right now. Okay, how about 2,000? They go, sure. You know, 3,000. They go, right? And then that's where I find their breaking point.
Sure.
And so whenever I get to their breaking point, is when we would determine whether this is viable or not. Because I know that the $10,000 debt will go away from maybe 4 to 5. But if they're unable or unwilling to spend more than 3, I know that we have an issue here and we're not going to be able to make it happen. So they may have to wait 2 years. But if they're comfortable spending 3, even 4, I know we can make it happen and we can get them mortgage ready without them having to wait it out. So it's not a, you know, one size fits all. It's really is an analysis of what are you willing to pay to buy now and what are you willing to save to buy later.
Yeah. And I love that concept of it's very specific to that particular individual and their credit history. So one thing I see a lot in my industry on credit reports is divorce. Divorce can be just wreak havoc on a credit report. Historically, because if a couple had joint debts or one person of the spouses actually controlled making payments.
That is a whole episode in its own.
It really is. But my point in bringing this up is that these are things that are related to mortgages. And I think that people don't realize this. And that's why I bring it up, you know. One last thing, finishing point, judgments. What's changed recently on mortgage credit reports that you've noticed about judgments?
Our good friends over at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, they actually sued. It was actually 36 state attorney generals sued the credit bureaus.
Wow.
For bad data, you know, bad data integrity. And they part of the settlement under this lawsuit was a deal with the CFPB that the three credit bureaus would change the standards that they use to report public records on credit reports.
Mm-hmm.
So credit reports historically for the last 50 years have had judgments on the reports. They've had tax liens on the credit reports.
Yes.
And they've had bankruptcies on the credit reports. Well, this lawsuit resulted in them changing how the data got on the report and the quality control of the data. Well, that lasted about a year and a half. The CFPB was still not happy with public records on credit reports. They just said that there wasn't, I mean, the credit bureaus would put things on reports without verifying dates of birth, social security numbers, right? So you could have another John Doe's stuff on your credit report.
Which I've seen.
And that can be very damaging if it's a judgment.
Uh-huh.
So they decided that they would just get rid of judgments and tax liens on credit reports altogether. So now the only thing that's on credit reports are if you filed bankruptcy.
Yes.
And the only reason why that works is because bankruptcies have the last four of the social on the public record. So the bureaus are able to match the data correctly as opposed to judgments, which they typically don't have the social as a matter of public record. So now you can look at a credit report and there'll be no judgment, but there can be a judgment like hidden or dormant.
Yes.
You know, and you go, you open up a transaction and then escrow finds it and then it completely derails the transaction.
So you brought that up, escrow finds it. So there's a report that is run on every applicant in a transaction, specifically the seller and the buyers. It's called SI or Statement of Information. So on this, they actually ask for your name, full name, legal name, your social, your date of birth, and your residences for the last 5 years. I think it goes back as far as 10. And this is a very important component to having clear title. A mortgage lender will not typically issue a loan if we cannot obtain clear title. And what that means is that we as a lender don't want to have a lien posted against the house we just helped close and put a lien on if it's going to have a judgment recorded against the property or leaned on that property. So that is, it's immensely important to fill it out. It's very private data. You know, this is that fine line that sometimes people joke and ask, you know, are you going to take a blood sample next? Because your mortgage lender is going to be looking for a lot of data. But they're really doing so. They're making a good credit decision. That's ultimately what it comes down to. So I wanted to bring up in the mortgage world, since we've had these changes with what the CFPB had mandated with the removal of judgments, we run sophisticated reports. Our particular vendor is CoreLogic, and they actually run a report called Data Verify. And these reports will find public record data, but our reports only go back 10 years. And that's it's kind of a it's a touchy one because there are some people that have when you take an application, they have a declaration section. It's the last page of the application, and they ask you very specific questions. And one of the questions is, are there any open, outstanding judgments against you? And you, as a consumer, have to answer yes or no. And then you sign this little thing that says under perjury, you know, that you're not aware of anything and that you are free of these things. So that report, though, is very detailed.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, well, judgments are only enforceable for 10 years. So that's probably why it goes back 10 years.
And I think that's the thing. But see, when we have, an example of somebody that had, say, a tax lien, and it recorded as a judgment, we actually have to have that cleared because it's a federal tax item, okay? But it didn't show up on our report.
And so because it didn't show up on the report, the score is higher.
The score was fine. There was no issues with the score.
Well, but if it was in the report, the score would be lower.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah. That's,
but escrow had to clear it.
Yep.
And we couldn't close the transaction without it.
Yep.
But you know what happened? The borrowers just got busy, didn't think of anything, and just drug their feet in getting the SI completed early in the transaction.
Oh,
so we were literally 5 days from closing. They already signed their loan documents. They're ready to get this thing done so they can get their keys. And then they run the SI report.
And that's exactly the danger of this item, these items missing from credit reports, is because now you won't catch them
correct
on the front end when you look at the report. If it was 2 years ago, you would have seen it on the report. And you wouldn't have opened escrow until it was dealt with. Now escrow's open, we're all the way to closing, and then we have to deal with it. And it becomes particularly harmful for the consumer if it's a judgment that they have to pay.
Yes.
And then the debt collector gets a demand from escrow saying, how much is the payoff so we can pay you because the client's in escrow. And guess what the debt collector says? Oh, well, we're going to add on our interest, our attorney's fees, and all of a sudden you have a giant debt that you got to pay.
And you know, the thing is, no time
to negotiate.
Yes, and that's one of the biggest hardships is because you've already gone through this process. You've got a lot of money on the line. They really have you against the ropes.
Yeah.
You either close it or you cancel, potentially losing your deposit and any inspection expenses that you went through.
I can tell you those are my favorite ones to deal with.
I know, but it's you know, you and Josh Wilson, who's a trust state's attorney, he in estates and wills, he says the same thing. He says, you know, I actually love people that don't put together a trust and have assets because you actually create billable hours for me, but you actually are not protecting yourself the way you should. So that's another podcast. Hey, Anselmo, I really, really appreciate the time today. I think this was a fun discussion. I always learn something when I talk with you. How can they reach you? How can our podcast listeners reach you? What's the
you
best
know, we way? Have our own podcast.
You do?
So your
what's the name of that?
You can check out theextracreditshow.com. And check out our podcast there, where it's more centered around credit.
And you guys do video. You get you get to see the most interesting man in the world before he becomes that.
But so the Extra Credit Show is everywhere: iTunes, Google Play, it's on Stitcher, and you can. It's also on YouTube. That's where our video cast is. So if you want to find the Extra Credit Show, you want to watch the visual, it's on YouTube, the Extra Credit Show. But I think most of our podcasts are consumed in audio format. It's just awesome podcasts, consuming podcasts while you're driving, at the gym, you know, just doing housework around the house, listening to a podcast. It's just very, you can do other things while consuming content. So it's great. But yeah, theextracreditshow.com. You can find us on social media as well with that hashtag, theextracreditshow. And then also you can find Innovative Credit Solutions online at icscreditfix.com. Once again, that's icscreditfix.com. And that's our actual firm, Innovative Credit Solutions.
Well, again, thank you so much for your time, Anselmo. Always a pleasure. I appreciate your expertise and just an opportunity to just talk to you. You're a good friend of mine. I know your family. And I'm just so proud to have you on my team. So thanks again.
Likewise, too, man. I share the same sentiments and I can't wait to come back on your show.
There's tons of topics.
Yeah. So thanks again.
All right. Take care.